class just about as close to 2 o'clock as possible. So we've had presentations from Transnet and SAA respectively through the morning session, and the third and final formal presentation of the day is by Andrew Shaw, who's the DDG, or the Deputy Director General, responsible for the transport SOEs within the Department of Public Enterprises. I've known Andrew for many years, and it's a great pleasure for me to welcome him. And again, not unlike with SAA and Transnet, unlike previous years, we gave a very brief or very wide brief for Andrew to interpret how he would like to present today. Andrew, welcome.
Thanks very much, Derek. And thanks for the opportunity to present. What I'm going to do is, I think, very much in line with how Winter School has been run before, is do a little bit of blue sky thinking in the first presentation. So I have two very short presentations. And the first one really deals with the challenges that are faced in freight logistics. So it relates very closely to Transnet and very specifically pick out some of the issues in respect of freight rail. It actually fits in quite nicely with what we have presented this morning, and there's a few areas of overlap that I think we could also use to discuss at some later point. Thereafter, what I'd like to do is present to you the DPE's African Aviation Strategy. I don't think anybody in this committee has had the opportunity to really see this, but it really represents a government vision for using our shareholding of both South African Airways and South African Express Airways to enhance African aviation coverage. So that I think will perhaps answer some of the questions. It'll probably pose a lot more, but it will hopefully answer some of the questions that we had earlier about how South African Airways, that are both of them, South African Express and SAA, can expand into Africa to the mutual benefit of both the continent but also the airlines themselves. If we go into this presentation, which really deals with the freight logistics arena, I'd like to speak a little bit about globalization of logistics. It's a point that we raised earlier. I'd like to bring just to the committee some of the issues in respect of what is happening in respect of road freight, rail freight, intermodal connections, how they operate, and ports. Which is really a little bit of international experience, but it also deals with some South African experience, particularly on the road freight side. And then the last set of bullets, which in a slightly different color, is really the implications for South Africa, the implications of lowering the cost of logistics, the challenges that we face around road versus rail, how do we enhance Transnet freight rail, what is Transnet infrastructure investment, which we shared with you? How does it fit into this picture? Give you a sense of where that is. And then pose right at the end, what kind of partnerships can we create for investment which stimulates the sector to be more responsive to the needs of the South African economy? In terms of globalization of logistics, the introduction of containers is something that is relatively recent, and I don't think people always realize that in about the 1950s and 1960s, early 1960s, there was no containers used within the port or the logistics system. Over that time, they've become to dominate particularly the high-value trade. Everything from even bulk products, food products, frozen products, right through to high-value goods like TVs, etc., are stuffed into containers in parts of the world, shipped out to other parts of the world. And part of this globalization of logistics is also based on huge exports from Southeast Asia, China particularly, into the Western markets of the US and Europe. And if you look on this, I don't know if somebody had that pointer, Luke, if you've got that there somewhere, it might be useful just to demonstrate. But what you have is huge east-west flows from the ports in Southeast Asia across to the ports in Europe and the US. What we've also seen in this model, thanks very much, is a huge shift to volume as the driver of reduction in costs. Here you have the export ports, and here you generally have import ports. Obviously, these ports are involved in both import and export, but the balance of trade is skewed very much in this direction towards Europe and the US. The volume dimension is based both on the ability to use a box to move things, so you can move things very rapidly. You can store them in stacks. you can move them out and ship them out very rapidly. There are a number of transshipment terminals that have emerged around the world. Singapore is one of the dominant ones. Dubai is another dominant one. And what we've also seen is that the bigger ports have got bigger and the smaller ports have got smaller. And it's something that in South Africa I'm not sure we've always been 100% attuned to. If you look at Europe, there were dominant ports in Europe for the last last three, four hundred years in the UK, in France, both dominant colonial powers. What we have now in Europe is only three major ports left. We have Rotterdam, which is the largest port in Europe, Antwerp, and Hamburg. Everything in and out of Europe is moving through these three centers now, almost. I mean, let's not oversimplify. If you go to the US, the exact same dimension. You have Los Angeles and New York as the two dominant ports in the world. In South Africa, what we've tended to do is we've tended to focus on generating a lot of smaller ports, and we haven't taken advantage of some of these mega flows of traffic. And the way that the mega flows of traffic have influenced the market is that container vessels, much like oil tankers in the generations prior to them, have grown larger and larger over time. First generation vessels in the 1970s, relatively small converted vessels. We're now up to post-Panamax plus vessels, 5,000 to 8,000 TEUs. They're talking about vessels that are post the 20,000 TEU mark already in the design stage. These vessels require quite significant drafts to get into ports. They require a long quayside. They require a number of cranes to uplift the containers on them. These fifth generation vessels generally only make 5 port calls on a round the world journey. If you're not one of those port calls, you're actually outside of the dynamics of global trade. So for South Africa to be part of this global trade dynamic, we actually need to be connected to these main hubs. We are partly connected. We're one of the only ports in the southern hemisphere to actually feature on this map through the port of Durban. And part of the challenge for us from a global trade perspective is to sustain our linkage into international shipping markets. And that means that we need to have ports that can hold these large vessels. We need to have the volumes that can attract these large vessels. And we needed the turnaround times to make sure that these large vessels will call at our ports. Because the notion of these large vessels is if they can't be cleared within a day or two, they generally won't call at that particular port. If you have a look at what is happening in respect of these larger vessels, in the 1990s, there were no 5,000 TEU plus vessels. And over time, the proportion of container vessels have grown so that 30% of the vessels in the current fleet in 2006 are 5,000 TEUs plus. The smaller vessels, the proportion of the global container fleet that is made up of the smaller vessels is declining. So we have to design a port system and a logistics system that is actually able to deal with larger volumes of traffic. And if you add to this the ship orders in 2006, you'll see that the largest ship orders are all in the bottom area. They're all in the large vessel size. One of the challenges and one of the benefits for South Africa about larger vessels is that they struggle to get through the Panama Canal, and they increasingly struggle to get also through the Suez Canal, which means that they can, more often than not, can find themselves on routings that are coming past southern Africa. So there is some benefit in all of these things which actually benefit the larger economies of the world, is the fact that we might have these vessels coming past us more and more in the future. Okay, so that's some challenges around maritime trade. What I would like to do is shift from here and move into some of the other modes. And I'd like to show you a little local company. Not very big. And I'd like to show you the challenge that a little local company like this presents. The trucking industry in South Africa has given a lot of heat. It's given a lot of heat because it overloads. It's given a lot of heat because it's taken stuff away from rail. But the reality is that the growth of South Africa, from a freight perspective and from an economic perspective since the 1990s, has been based almost entirely on growth in road freight. And I'll demonstrate that to you in a later slide. What these companies have done is they've very rapidly taken on the international model of 3PL or 4PL services, logistics services. And these services go well beyond provision of just trucking services. These services go on specialized provision for specialized customers, distribution, warehousing, providing just-in-time services to different companies around the world, a company called Value Logistics, which started out as a trucking company, has a small company that is owned by it called FreightPak. FreightPak operates only within the chemical sector. It has specialized distribution hubs. It has specialized vehicles that focus on dealing just with chemical products. It offers a range of services. I've tried to highlight some of these. It offers a very traditional road freight service, intercity. It offers logistics across the country, very, very standard trucking practice. But what it also does is it operates national warehousing and distribution. It holds the customer's product. It ships the customer's product when it feels it's necessary based on its analysis of the situation. So effectively what has happened is that chemical companies are focused on their core market, which is producing chemicals. The logistics element is actually passed out to a company such as this, so that this element is now held by the logistics company, which deals with just-in-time delivery, with warehousing, and with distribution. It links into air freight market. Unfortunately, it doesn't link into the rail freight market, which is one of the downsides that we have. It operates a full supply chain model. It's a relatively small company, but I think it demonstrates where this market is going internationally. And it demonstrates partly the challenge that I think is faced by Transnet, in that one of the key modes that could play a role in this is rail. The question that we should ask ourselves is, how do we link rail into this in a way that integrates with a provider such as FreightPak, but in a way that also takes and captures market share away from FreightPak or companies such as this? We won't talk about Vala World Logistics because Derek, who sits at the back there, is too intimately involved. So I had to choose a competitor to them. Smiling under his breath. Rail freight can be a core component. In the US, rail freight is growing, particularly in containers. In Europe, it's growing because of congestion. The rail faces a challenge. It generally was the mode of choice two, three, 4 decades ago. It's moving back to a focus on block trains, where you try and meet the needs of supply chain of customers by offering a scheduled service. You move within a block train, you don't tend to mix traffic. You operate a scheduled service from point to point. The ability to offer track and trace means that you can offer proactive customer information. Punctuality, security, all the issues that Vuya has already indicated to us. There's real opportunity for integrated rail solutions in some of the bigger sectors where specialized wagons, specialized equipment is required. Automotive is one. It's an area where freight rail already plays a role. It could play a more substantial role by being more proactive around the kind of equipment and the services that it offers. Chemicals is a very interesting rail-friendly product because it's quite often hazardous. But it's also a product where the rail provider has to be extremely innovative. Chemical companies quite often want to hold the stock in wagons as a way of feeding into their own manufacturing process. So in other words, they want to use it as a way of storing products. The chemical products are becoming more and more complex, and they require more and more technologies that are aligned to that kind of business practice. And of course, containers, which have become the growing mode of freight. Just prior to the recession, containers in South Africa have been growing at about 12% per annum. Massive growth in containerized products. And then technology and innovations, and I think some of these, as we'll see, are partly being implemented in Transnet, but the ability to link with road freight, the ability to load palletized products, technology development in wagons, double stacking of containers, all opportunities that we can use to enhance rail. Part of the challenge of this is that those cost money. The other part of the challenge is it requires more innovative and more adaptable management within the rail environment. And that, of course, represents a challenge when you take into account the background that Vuya has sketched out in respect of where Transnet has come from. Intermodal port connections. I won't go into all the detail. There's a lot of text on the slide, but intermodal port connections are becoming the focus of what's happening in the world. As the world becomes more focused on one or two major hub ports, distributors are linking more closely into the hub. And I went to a seminar some time back along with some Transnet colleagues, and it was quite interesting to me that some of the distribution centers, instead of being outside the port now, are now finding themselves inside the port. So the container doesn't even get moved into a stack. It gets moved from the ship into a distribution center. And the example here is Asda, which is one of the big UK distribution chains. has a distribution center inside the port of Quayside in the UK, which means that containers vessels dock, the containers come off the ship, they go immediately into the distribution center. The ports are offering much more than they offered in the past, and we have to be more adaptable around these kinds of logistics challenges that we face. This is an intermodal center that's in Graz in Austria. Part of the focus of this intermodal center is that it deals with the interface between road and rail. But what it does is that it attracts private sector partners into owning and operating their own logistics and distribution centers within the property portfolio of this distribution center. So what you can see here is all the major third-party distribution centers are represented, DHL, Panalpina, etc., Schenker, which is one of the big German 3PL, 4PL companies, all hold properties within this logistics center, and rail is the dominant mode of intercity traffic within the center. Now, we know that Transnet has a lot of plans around this area, but this is just to give you a picture of where the world is going and the challenges that Transnet faces around taking Transnet from where it is now. It's quite dramatic improvements in efficiency and productivity and infrastructure into a new realm of provision of logistics. Part of the challenges that South Africa, and I move now from the international example into some of the challenges that we face in South Africa, is that we have some of the highest logistics costs in the world. I don't wish to underestimate what Rio said about us having an effective logistics system, but we are faced with the challenges that we are distant from global markets. Our main manufacturing hub is 600 kilometers from the coast. Most of our mining activity happens substantial distances from the nearest port, which means that about 15-16% of our cost of trade is tied up in logistics. If we can reduce that by just 1%, we are substantially more competitive than competing nations, particularly for things like rolled steel, manufactured products such as autos, etc., where the margins are very, very tight. The challenges raised around tariffs, I wouldn't like to repeat, I think, where you've in a sense raised it very proactively in this forum, and I really thank you and appreciate that, because it is a challenge for us going forward. Sustaining tariffs which are supportive of the growth of rail is one of the biggest challenges that we face, but at the same time supporting infrastructure investments and enhancements in rail assets within the Transnet business. The global economic downturn has also placed considerable pressure on Transnet, and you can see that on the slide that we have demonstrated, where you can see how the EBIT margin has fallen at a time when actually the volume has increased. And people are struggling to hear.
I think we can do better if I push it on. Don't worry.
Okay. Perhaps part of our challenge is this challenge here. The slide that Rio indicated to you is that road is a higher cost mode than rail, but product is increasingly moved from road to rail, partly because the efficiency and the reliability of the rail system are poor, partly because the products that we move within the national economy have changed. They've become higher value products. And here you can see the proportion of traffic that has moved from road to rail since the 1950s. Now, up until about 1980s, middle 80s, we had a regulated environment where roads was really kept out of the freight mix. From that period, road has really captured significant market share. Part of it has done through the model that I demonstrated to you previously. They've become much more adaptable to the needs of their customers. Part of the challenge is that at that time, and prior to 2003, we had a real challenge that Transnet was really, through what was then known as Spoornet, was not really able to produce the services that the economy required. Now, part of that challenge is being addressed, but the challenge still remains. The other part of the challenge is that if you're not growing market share, it's very difficult to grow volume without putting your prices up. And that's perhaps one of the central challenges that Transnet faces at the moment. Is if we could capture even a small portion of this road market share, we could have a growing market under which revenue would increase, volume would increase, we'd be able to reinvest more significantly in rail, and it would become more sustainable. This diagram, which was done probably about 3 or 4 years ago now, demonstrates the extent of the heavy vehicle mix on the National Road Network, and you can see where all the red is, where you have two axle heavy vehicles, generally the heavier axle vehicles, and the extent to which they dominate the freight, dominate the traffic mix. And it's on many of the corridors where road is competing with rail. The N3 is the one of the significant ones. The N1 is another one. The links in and out of SADC, into Zimbabwe, Botswana, down here, where the rail is actually very effective as a mode. Many of these routes are actually competing directly with the rail network that we have in place. So there is an opportunity to move a lot of this freight from this network onto the Transnet network. Transnet has developed an infrastructure development plan. It's based on developing infrastructure ahead of demand, so it's effective in a way that it was never, that Transnet infrastructure investment was never in the past. The focus is to align to various commodities which are rail friendly and port friendly, containers being a key one of those, automotive, break bulk, dry bulk. Provide capacity through operational efficiencies as a priority, and we can see some of those efficiencies lifting now. In some instances, they're still quite far from international best practice, but you know, from where we sit in DPE, it is quite heartening to see that the indicators are improving. Indicators of ship turnaround, of container moves per hour, wagon utilization, loco utilization, all of the indicators that that we've selected and that we've included in the shareholder compact, while they may be off from global benchmarks, are all increasing year on year, and that is heartening to see. There has to be an alignment between this plan and the National Road and Electricity Supply Planning, which I think is an ongoing process that we probably need to ensure happens effectively. Now, the reason that I put this slide up is that it identifies the rail planning and the port planning principles that Transnet have identified, and they align very much with the first slide that I showed you, because the first slide indicates to you where the logistics market is going into in the future. And I think part of the thinking that's happened in Transnet Capital Projects around the infrastructure investment program is to take Transnet through the infrastructure program to a place that it wasn't before. And I'll take you through some of those. Separate out metro trains from freight lines. In other words, make the efficiency of the freight system much more effective. Operate hub to hub. In other words, intermodal hub to intermodal hub, such as what I indicated to you is happening in ports in the UK, in Austria, the example of intermodal facility. Provide intermodal infrastructure, which is the focus of what is happening in other parts of the world, linking distribution centers into rail, linking road into rail. Separation of the core and the branch line network. Most railways are not effective on the branch line network any longer at a corporate level. Their focus is to operate block trains on the primary network. Transnet is moving very rapidly to take the branch lines and take those lines to private sectors through a concessioning process that we're working with together with DOT, and to ensure that rural access is provided through that process and that links into the core network. Port planning principles. Port planning principles: improve operational efficiency, improve port specialization, which is exactly what's happening in other parts of the world, particularly a focus on attracting containers to certain ports, focus on bulk in other ports. Sustainability and environmental responsibility. Complement new port expansion with commercial development, exactly what is happening around intermodal centers in other parts of the world. I won't go into this slide in a lot of detail, but this just demonstrates the focus on an intermodal type strategy within the Transnet infrastructure plan, and also a focus of shifting certain commodities, particularly containers and vehicles, from more of a road focus to more of a rail focus. This is the plan for rail in terms of infrastructure investment from 2006 to 2030. It indicates, as you can see, a heavy emphasis on the primary rail network from Gauteng down to Cape Town, from Gauteng to the Eastern Cape, particularly the Port of Kuga, PE East London. This is the dominant corridor by far from a freight perspective, the N3, or at least a high-value freight perspective. And then our export line, which is really focused in this area. And you can see the freight flows, how this correlates with where the dominant heavy vehicle traffic is on the road network that was shown on one of the previous slides. Well, now this is like a bit of a busy slide, so maybe I'll just talk to some of the issues here. But certainly what we see here as one of the biggest challenges that is faced by Transnet is that there is a challenge in respect of the ability of freight rail to generate revenues which show real profitability in the freight rail arena. Transnet is too reliant on the National Ports Authority as a revenue generator. We need to reconsider Transnet Freight Rail's realistic market position. We need to put it into a market position where it's able to grow freight traffic, where it's able to align more closely to what is happening in other parts of the world, and where it's able to work more closely with customers and with road freight providers. And that perhaps is one of the central challenges that we face. While we've supported this notion of a vertically integrated railway, I think we've posed the challenge to Transnet of how do you encourage other players to join you within this freight rail environment in such a way that you enhance the product offering of something such as FreightPak that I demonstrated to you earlier, or the offering of another logistics provider, or the offering of a customer. That customer may be in the chemical sector, and they may not be using rail at the moment, or they may be in the rail sector, and rail is not meeting their full needs at the moment. How do we encourage that occurs? Well, part of the process, as we put forward, and really this is, I suppose, a point of debate, is bring that customer closer to your business. Allow that customer to invest in your business. Allow that customer to put some skin in the game. Work more closely with that customer. Focus on integrating more closely with that customer. Logistics, as we've seen around the world, is actually about integrating the needs of various parts of the supply chain in a way that actually provides an optimal result to the customer who generally actually doesn't want to be in the logistics environment. Most people that are in retail or in chemicals, etc., for them, logistics is a problem. It is not a part of their core business in most instances. In most instances, they'd rather off sell it to somebody else. There is a real opportunity, I think, for Transnet Freight Rail in particular, to become much more closely aligned to a full supply chain type model. And that's where I'd like to leave it. Thank you very much. I don't know, Derek, we can take some questions or we can move into the aviation one.
No, let's move into, with your kind permission, let's move into the aviation one and then we'll do the questions okay. All together. Is that okay with everyone? Okay, thanks then.
You're not to navigate to the...
Yeah, I'm not to navigate. This version of PowerPoint, I'm a bit... How do I get it to show on the other side now? Oh, is it?
There we go. Can you see it now?
Yeah. So in government, we unfortunately are a little bit behind the software dimension of our private sector colleagues, or for that matter, the SAE. So we're still on 2003, which...
You just triggered a security alert as well, so I think there's something wrong.
Okay, this is a very different presentation. What I'd like to share with you here is what we've come up over a period of probably a year and a half. It's termed the African Aviation Strategy. It's really a process of working closely with South African Airways and with South African Express to enhance the investment and the benefits that we gain from aviation expansion into Africa. As you know, and as you've seen from SAA, Africa represents a real profitability and opportunity for the carrier. SAA offers the opportunity to focus on the areas or the routes where there's high demand. South African Express Airline, for those of you who've flown to smaller destinations like Kimberley and Richards Bay, Lumumbashi in DRC, Windhoek, etc., SACS operates turboprops and smaller jets, generally 100 seats or less, to these smaller destinations. So it operates much more of a regional service. It really supports some of the activity of integrating some of the smaller towns into the main aviation network. So it quite often brings passengers from these smaller areas to hubs such as Owatambo, where they can then link into SAA's balance of their network. They share the same code. They're very often the customers actually don't know that they're two completely separate airlines because the branding is very similar. Our focus has been how do we encourage airlines to SAA and SAA Express, one of which is financially very solid, SAA Express, one of which SAA is financially very constrained. How do we encourage them to develop in a way in Africa which enhances the coverage across Africa, works with other aviation or other airlines within Africa. And I think part of what I'll show you now is our strategy for doing that. So government strategic intent is to improve Africa's travel outcomes. We're very clear that Africa faces enormous challenges in respect of travel. Infrastructure is poor. The continent is highly fragmented. At a road and rail level, infrastructure is not adequate to support the operations. At an aviation level, quite often it's a protected market. It is not very well developed, and many airports are not effective. And that really is the current structure that we have in the central bloc. And of course, the travel outcomes of that are that many people who have to transfer from African country to African country will either do it through places like Johannesburg, London, Paris. In the case of West Africa, is probably one of the largest West African hub is Paris. Increasingly through Dubai, Africa has not really been able to build off the linkages that are starting to develop between African countries. But at the same time, that represents a huge opportunity, particularly if you're based within the continent, as SAA and SACS are. There's opportunities from a business perspective. A lot of African travel is business focused. There's unlocking tourist opportunities, and there are cargo opportunities. A lot of freight that would otherwise be moved by road is being moved by air. South Africa has also identified a strong commitment to Africa in terms of assisting where it can in integrating certainly the subcontinent, but actually relatively far up the continent. From a commercial perspective, we recognize that the financial viability of airlines can also be enhanced through profitable opportunities on the continent. And this is really proven in the case of both SAA and SACS. If you divide the businesses within SAA, Africa is the most profitable of the three entities within SAA. The domestic is really break-even to slightly profitable, and it's intercontinental which really struggles to remain break-even and is in most instances slight loss-making. So in a way, Africa has actually assisted South African Airways to sustain its financial viability up until now. And the situation is not all that different for SA Express. Although it's financially much more sustainable than SAA, its expansion into Africa is really where its expansion opportunities lie. The current regulatory environment in Africa, however, is challenging for both SAA and SA Express. Regulations generally have tried to keep non-nationals out of the market. There's still support for inefficient national carriers based in various African countries. Some African countries have opened up much more than others. Some remain almost completely closed. It's challenging for both SAA and SACS to get bilateral rights to operate within Africa. Airlines wanting to grow in Africa must focus on growing volumes to and from the region, and they have to have the rights to operate these. So part of the strategy is to work with African carriers as opposed to working in competition with them. Part of the challenge is to work in competition, but part of our challenge is to work much more in collaboration with them. And the focus here is that if we can build better services, create better frequency, we can grow volume growth, we can become more competitive, and we can become more responsible and flexible in respect of the regulatory regime. So part of this process is an incremental process of change. The vision is that the interdependencies between SAA and SACS are really not as strong as they ought to be. If we look at other comparative airlines, particularly Lufthansa, we see that the interrelationships between the regional carrier and the mainline carrier are much, much stronger. The founding act for both airlines defined distinct operational spaces, so we have created a situation where the legislation supports SAA as the dominant mainline carrier and supports SAA Express as the dominant regional carrier in such a way that they are not directly competing with one another. Effectively, there are some overlaps and there are some areas where competition does occur, but the focus is to create collaboration. We have identified that SAA will predominantly, and this is not really a strict cutoff, but will predominantly favor aircraft of 100 seats or more. SACS will use aircraft of 100 seats or less as the main cutoff between the operations of the two airlines. The envisaged strategy of SAA is to be a leading large gauge point-to-point operator with a focus on OTIA is Oliver Tambo International Airport, for those who haven't seen the new jargon, to primary airports across Africa. SACS, as an owner or a part owner of regional and domestic small gauge feeder carriers across Africa. So in a sense, we are encouraging SACS, who we haven't seen today, and perhaps we should invite to present directly to this committee. We're encouraging SACS to work much more closely with other regional carriers around Africa to provide regional support services. And they are beginning to do this in the DRC, one of their first areas of expansion, but also for SACS to work much more closely with SAA to enhance development across the country, across the continent. There are three areas where we've encouraged development to occur. The first is where existing developments are currently underway, and maybe Jan, you might want to comment about this after this session, but the commercial agreement is currently being drawn up and finalized between the two airlines. We would encourage service agreements to follow on, and a Voyager agreement is already in place. But what we would need to do is ensure that if SACS is working in collaboration with other carriers, that the Voyager component of that can also be passed on in such a way that the Voyager program can be expanded along with the expansion into Africa. The envisaged strategy in respect of SAA is establish itself as a leading network carrier. It's already done that. It's already the largest network carrier in Africa. There's opportunity to expand. SAA and ourselves are working closely with Department of Transport to get the bilateral process to open up more and more markets. Recent market expansions are places like Angola, huge opportunities in that kind of space as it grows. West Africa, again, massive opportunities, and also within Central Africa. The secondary focus is to opportunistically offer intercontinental services from Africa, from African countries who grant fifth freedom rights. Fifth freedom rights are the rights to pick up passengers in a second country and transport them to a third country, if I've simplified that correctly. SAA is already doing this in Senegal by offering a service from here across to the US, but there are opportunities to do the same in places like Angola. There are opportunities in other parts of Africa where SAA can begin to offer fifth freedom opportunities that link other African countries that have relatively poor linkages into the developed market, particularly Europe, the US, and Asia. So there are some quite significant opportunities in this space. Obviously, I won't go through all the strengths, but SAA has enormous strengths in doing this. Part of their success has been that they have been able to cover this market before anyone else has got into the market. But there are also a number of challenges. The most specific of these challenges is that SAA is faced with a very weak balance sheet. And until we rectify that balance sheet, even partially, it puts SAA in a difficult position to expand its network of operations. Route expansion requires a lead time in order to become profitable. SAA is in a position where it's not always, or it's difficult for it to accept loss leaders in a market such as Africa. If we move to SACS, the strategy around SACS is for it to work either on its own or together with other operators to begin to expand regional services at the major hubs that are either connection points of SAA or other mainline carriers, in such a way that we expand regional services in a starburst kind of approach across the continent. So already we have a relatively good regional footprint over here, in fact a very good regional footprint, which is shared with Air Link. And we'd have to work more closely with Air Link. There is an opportunity to begin to expand around DRC, but we've put some of these other opportunities in place just to demonstrate what may be possible. West Africa, East Africa. By doing such a strategy, what you do is you actually make it easier for carriers such as SAA to begin to develop much greater volumes on these core routes across this network. The key strengths of SA Express is that it can move into markets relatively easily, financially very sustainable as an airline. It's well capitalized, and it has the potential to attract business partners that SAA doesn't. And I say this with respect, but SAA is often in Africa seen to be the big brother. It seems to want to dominate the aviation sector, Whereas SAA Express is a much smaller airline. It has proven to be easier to work with smaller airlines across Africa because it's not seen to be so much of a dominant player in the aviation market. So the current positioning is regional operator using a single mainline-owned regional brand or code, which is the SAA code. Begin to move to a regional operator using multiple mainline-operated brands or codes. And that may require that SA Express moves either to its own code or establishes different codes if it's feeding a regional market in a different part of Africa and working with another player. And ultimately to a regional operator using its own brand, perhaps a brand linked to SAA in a way that is discernible, that you can see the difference between these two airlines. But certainly in a focus which enables passengers from across Africa to differentiate this as a brand that is available in East Africa, West Africa, potentially Southern Africa. Okay, this really explains very much what I've already explained, so I won't go through this I won't explain this in a lot of detail, but that really is the end of the African aviation strategy as we posed it. We have worked together with both the management of SAA and SAA Express. Both managements are, I think, are very supportive of the strategy at a principal level, but the devil is definitely in the detail around this. There's a lot of challenges in terms of working in different markets. It is a very competitive environment, and both airlines are very aware of this. Our process in moving from here is to develop a structure which enables both airlines to come together, where we as shareholder can facilitate a more closely working relationship, and we're very keen to set this in place under the auspices of the new minister, and it would seem that we have the support of both carriers to do that. So I thought it was an important process just to share this with the committee so that they could see what we're up to in respect of trying to push this forward as a strategy. Thank you.
As opposed to directing questions specifically at you, invite all the participants to come to the barrack and we kick off with the panel and we can direct questions to whoever we like. And we aim to have about an hour and 15 minutes of that. So Andy, if I could invite you up. I need a chair. And my call center has reminded me that Peter and the chair have tons of questions. But I'm ready to take it. Good news is you don't even have to die.
I wanted to. I wanted to know when somebody books on an aeroplane and he doesn't get on, what is the form of compensation you were talking about? And then I see nothing about the test of their infrastructure. The information that I have is close to 1 billion rand a year that gets stolen and vandalized. And, I work in that sector, so I know Transnet is not doing very much to protect their assets. And although it is all over the country, it can be something that's difficult to protect. But if something like 20 kilometers of railroad track disappears, it doesn't disappear overnight, and you just can't hide it anywhere. But I see nothing about. And we are taxpayers, we don't mind paying, but we want to know that you look after your assets. Because if you don't look after your assets, then we will punish you somehow. Like you were saying, a lot of, and this is for both SAA and Transnet, it's not a big, jobs are outsourced. These people use staff that come from contractors. These people don't have job security, they don't own the job, they get turned around a lot, they are not secure, they are a security breach, a security risk. They also don't act always in the best interest of the company that is employing them. And one simple thing I would like to raise here is that when you hire a security guard to look after that pedestal, that is the only thing he will look after. They can carry away the whole building, but he's facing them up. And this is to make me doesn't make sense, you know. So that is one of the things that is a big problem for us, and we want to see something about that. We want to, as a portfolio committee, look into that. In most of these companies that work with taxpayers' money, we have raised it in our strat plan, so you can factor it in future presentations you are having. And about the ports, there was this issue. We had somebody that explained to us from Department of Energy,
economy, what is it?
Yeah, they came to us and they explained to us that we tax the people that have to dock there, and we are the only country in the world that is charging this very expensive tax for ships to come into our ports. And we would like to know something about that and why we are charging and making it so difficult for them to come here and to load up the stock here. And I think that is what the chairperson was alluding to, and not the cost of the product on the road and the explanation that you gave. I don't think that is what he was talking about. I think it was about that specific. I think, you know, a country like Zimbabwe charges carbon tax. It was something silly like a docking tax or something they were charging. And it was quite high, you know, it was the highest in the world, but we are also the only one. And then, that was Francis. And then SA8, I saw in the presentation on page 4 that you said Cruise Star offers 17,600 daily flights serving 943 destinations in 159 countries. So if we only have 56 airplanes, how can we do 15,000, 17,600 flights? I don't understand that. I mean, we, and then I was, this is the figure she gave this morning. The Star offers. Okay, then aircraft. I am under the impression that we actually rent these aircraft on a lease. But now we need a lot of money to buy them. I don't understand how that works. I need some explanation on, you know, if we are leasing. I hear people say that we lease these planes, the leases are coming to an end. So to me it means that while we are using it, we are paying for them. So why do we need to buy them? Or is there a time and then we have to pay a big amount to actually acquire them and then scrap them, or how does that work? And somebody raised in the portfolio committee previously that SAA actually don't do their own servicing of their planes. They have a contract with India or some other country, and they actually now service our planes. So I would suggest that we as a portfolio committee go to the airport, and what we want to see there at the airport would be one of these planes being serviced or something that we are actually doing. And we want to also see from the aeroplane to where the people pick up their luggage, how the system works. I want to understand why somebody can't sit there and watch the luggage or open it up. And I mean, this is a problem coming for a long time, and if you have investigators, they should know something going on there. And then I also want to see the readiness of the disaster teams on the airport. The fire brigade, it was said in the media that we are not ready for a big disaster, and then SAA and ACTA says, well, that's not true, but people inside that company that works there say, well, we are not ready. So I would like to go out and see if they are ready. I think it is our duty to go and do that. And yeah, I talked about the staff that the SAA emphasizes, the temporary staff. And yes, and in that visit could be in Cape Town and Johannesburg, because I think the biggest problem is at Johannesburg is the lungs. I want to see that. So every time I come to Johannesburg airport, something my case is open, but if I come to Cape Town, nothing happens. If I come from overseas too, but if I have a flight that stops in Johannesburg and comes to Cape Town, then the language is a problem. The case is cut open or whatever it is. So that is me.
Thank you. Next time, I count the king.
But if you
don't
do
that,
I'll
tell you twice over time. Because we
all
want to go to Trump.
I
don't
know.
They want
you. They want more.
I've got a lot of questions for SAA, and then only one I think for Transnet. The first, many of my studies was Transnet was oligopoly. When you enter into this arrangement with others, how do you make sure that we protect our interests? Because often we enter into this arrangement blindfolded, and we lose out in the end. We look attractive from outside, but how you negotiate and how you enter into partnership, are you always guarding against guarding in our interest? Okay, that's the only one thing. SAA, do you own cargo planes? If so, no. You only. When need arise, do you have a plan for that, or and how frequently and how much revenue do you gain or gather from cargo? And what are your plans for the future? Because if you say that you are breaking even almost to the domestic market, you are running almost at a loss to the international market, and it is Africa's market actually afloat. I presume that it's in terms of passenger transportation. But have you analyzed the possibilities of cargo in Africa also as the potential for growth? Linked with this question, Transnet earlier on showed and projected an increased demand, 10x a possible increase in demand in the future for iron ore, and India's one for coal. If you take coal and if you take iron ore, of course they're going to manufacture a whole lot of things that would need to be transported. As some of them might be very tiny, small items that can be carried by air. Some of them, if it is coal will derive byproducts, which might need also to be transported, but also it could fund, I'm talking to other SOEs that might be here or might not be here, the issue of manufacturing. So it's worrying us that you plan inside of the projections that Transnet are making, for instance, are not influencing anyone, including the SAA, which is in the same transport sector as Transnet. So we hope, in fact, I was disappointed when I learned that Dinel presented and that, because I think it is at the sessions where you sit together, you can pick up together, where you can foster, we can see opportunities for joint planning and joint cooperation. So my main issue is about cargo plans and cargo policy. The other thing relates to the Airbus. You've already answered the Airbus story, but I think you're too embroiled in resolving the Airbus saga without planning. If you say that your lease is attached to an end, in 2010 and 2011, and you don't know what you are going to do, and you are only a few months away from 2010 and 2011, it's unthinkable. And you are in a balance sheet that looks like your own. So I think you are too embroiled in your problem. So we also want to know your turnaround strategy. I don't think that the Airbus contract is the one and only thing that you spend a whole lot of your energy, so much so that you can't even plan ahead for other things. My next question is about fleet planning. I don't know if anybody asked about fleet planning. Transnet spoke about the locomotive. We want to know your long-term fleet planning strategy. If you say you want to move away from road to rail, what plans are you doing in terms of that, in terms of long-term purchase of locomotives, but also redevelopment or enhancing of the rail infrastructure? It cannot just be wishful thinking. We need to see in terms of the president, everything is linking together to take you to where you say you should be. The issue of the call center, I was very annoyed when somebody asked us in the US, in the US, because we know that the cost of telephony. So the first question I said to him is, who is paying for this cost? No, man, you don't have to worry. I said, I don't care. I don't have to worry. It might be taxpayers' money. It might not be me as an eagle. Is it FAA that is sharing the cost? Because for sure, calling the US has got cost implications. Who actually bears the cost? I cannot just be comfortable to say that yes, somebody is serving me and serving me efficiently. When I call, I end up in Europe or I end up. I need to know actually who bears the cost. I was going to ask about services. I thought you had a servicing of your fleet, SAA. This member gives me a fright sometimes. This member says that all hours. So if you say that you have maintenance and repair, that's so good, and you have planned to be the best one. The story that you're servicing abroad, how fast you is it, can we just give our peers? I didn't hear anything about corporate social investment. I think even when you are ailing in terms of your balance sheet, especially because you are a public entity, there's no way that even if a 2 cents or 5 cents, and in fact the next question is, do you have a policy? Transnet said they're spending 140 million over that. Is that determined by a policy? We'd like to interrogate the policy to increase. And risk management for FAA. What is your risk management? Is it in place? How good is it? That's one area we'd like to hear you speak about. Are you a delinquent? SAA. You're facing so much litigation. You can't afford an image of a delinquent national airline. We have delinquent companies all over, and now our airline is also appearing like a delinquent. I'm not asking for documents of a closed process, but we hope that we cannot afford an image of delinquency.
Thank you. Security breaches or theft to the extent of $1 million. But that does not mean that theft is not a serious problem in personal life. In fact, theft particularly of copper impacts seriously on the efficiency of operations, particularly if you look into the areas like the coal line. So that is an area that we're spending a lot of focus on. And one of the things we've been doing as part of responding to this problem around theft of related to non-ferrous metals is to use what is this new optic fiber. And the shortcut around it is that the thieves still go and remove them, only to find actually is really of no value to them and just dump it wherever that's the case.
They are using it now.
They're making bulletproof, better
rule of it.
So it's a matter that we've been doing a lot of work around, both in terms of our own investment and security, but also partnership with the law enforcement agencies, from the police to the intelligence agencies, because it's a serious problem impacting on not only ourselves, the number of other players, but as telecom and all. So this is a serious problem around that, and we're working with a number of agencies to deal with that. Coupled with that, I think you've raised the issue around probably in some instances assets that have not been used properly, but they're real assets. And which as a result, people are still in uplift. And I think we hope that a lot of that challenge should be resolved by the current focus around a secondary network study. You raised this some time in, I think, over a break around some lines that have been not used and the activity around them. The Director General of the Department of Transport has previously raised the point that the secondary network or the branch line are the live wires of the second economy. And because of that, DPE has been driving us to getting those branch line network back into action, and that would include looking into a process that would involve concessioning to private sector participants to be involved in the branch line network, both from accessing it from a passenger point of view to freight as well as some tourism, basically tourism. Right? So there's a lot of work now being done, which we're working on with DPE, which has not been finalized, and we'll ask you to go back to cabinet around how this process will be started. And I think it will deal with a fundamental part of it, because if most planes run around along that line, in many instances they end up being lesser attention. When you've got resources that are competing with different areas, you end up not putting a lot of attention in there, but I think it's clear now that with the work that's been done around the branch line network, there will be improvements around that. There shouldn't be instances where the network is totally ignored, and when we come across those, we've got to find ways to deal with that.
Just on a point of clarity on what you have said, and I need to tell you that you had an investigating team that specifically investigated the theft of non-ferrous metals, the vandalizing and the theft of your infrastructure. And you have disbanded it and outsourced this to a private security company that don't even speak our language. When they get on the scene, they don't know what's going on. It's like 3 days to get a hold of them to come and look after what is yours to protect. By that time, they have stolen everything already. So this is something that you have seriously have to look at. I would like to see a report on this. Why people that was working for the company have been taken out there to outsource it? Because it's not in the interest to catch the criminal. You know, because tomorrow they won't have another job. And you say it's not a lot of money. I say it is either a billion or hundreds of millions of rand. And if it's not true, then you must convince me.
I think let me firstly, I gave you the impression that it's minuscule amount, but certainly not a point. Clearly this is a major problem. And we give attention to all of this is saying that it's not at the extent that you raise it. It doesn't mean at all that you would ever say any such law should not have been lost. Is a problem. We've got to be attending to that. We have a mixture of both, particularly in the rail business, of both in-house security people as well as outsourced security people. And part of the arrangement now is to, with the public looking at, is to also include other state law enforcement people, because there are some areas where you actually need people with higher firing power than we are legalized to have, given the kind of criminals and the syndicates that are involved in some of them. So I'm not, the problem I want to emphasize, that there continues to be a serious problem relating to particularly non-credit men, which is impacting on the business and on productivity. As I've indicated to you, Sam, you have to stop the operations, because on one part of the line you find that a lot of copper has been so I don't want to therefore give any impression that it's not a serious matter. It is a serious matter, and clearly we'll come back and show you that we are likely requiring what are the steps that we're putting in place to deal with this problem. And as I indicate, they include our own internal measures, outsourced activity, as well as the involvement of other players in the state machinery on the law enforcement side. Jobs outsourced, we don't really have a lot of, we have staff complement of about 45,000, I think.
$45,000.
I was told earlier that if I continue making this mistake of millions, I'll resolve the employment problem for that.
There we are.
You employ even new body.
And so most of those employees are full time. They have been, however, particularly in one of our divisions, which is Charter Capital Project, and it's pretty much a historical issue where there is a lot of people known as contract employees. And to tell the truth about it is totally a silly thing that we ever got involved in. When you have people who've been contract employees for years, they end up not having a lot of the protection that they ought to be having. That's a matter which this year is part of the wage settlement negotiation process we engage on with labor, and are looking into mechanism around how we resolve that and send it around. Because we too accept that it's totally an unacceptable position. So there's no problem around us sending around that way, because it's not supposed to have been that way. But it happens, of course. I mean, some of them are, like I said, like in the case of some of them, probably over 10, 15 years. And the person is considered to be so. Those are some of the problems that we are attending to. It's clearly an issue that is not acceptable, and attention is being given to that, together working together with our union. Post charges law sometimes are referred to as cargo dues. It's one of those issues that it's not always easy to get to the real truth about whether are we totally out of kilter with others or not, because, and this is and DPE would confirm this, because DPE is currently running a study on that to Tina Ferro and associates. And the real point about this is that you can't, you know, like cross the globe. There's not one system of pricing or charging, so that you could equally see that you're comparing apples with apples. And so in some instances, you'll find in some ports, because the port systems in other countries
are really an integral part of, let's say, the city government of this. So you find that the city, the sum part of the funding of the infrastructure for that port in the city, which comes from the city itself, and which of course it will generate to all manner of other charges, rates, etc. There's other funding which comes through taxes, national taxation. So in some way you might look into the actual amount that you pay directly and say, well, you pay better for this than compared to in another country. Whereas if you step back, you find that there's another mechanism where that other amount you're not paying is subsidized either through local taxation or through national taxation. But we've done a comparison, and I think this is an important matter which has been raised by the portfolio committee. We would want to come to the portfolio committee and provide the study that we've done around this and compare in the sense of different tables how we compare. But you will find that in some areas we compare favorably, in others maybe not favorably.
So we're bringing you with DCI and industry in one meeting in ourselves. Because we won't
trust the study
that much,
the view
of
the study.
So don't worry,
it
will be the four of
us. I look forward to that, especially because by nature the customers will argue that whatever we're charging is too high. And I think it will help us. This is a matter that we take very seriously, particularly as we move into an environment of the regulation of our territory. And so we all are seeking to get to what are these benchmarks that we're going to be looking at. So, and I suspect the study that CCE has commissioned Sheila Ferdinand and Associates to carry out will also assist in that process as well. You raised the question around partnerships. I mean, clearly, for us, it was indicated, as been indicated also by Andrew, we've got to create critical partnerships. And in fact, one of the key points that the minister raised related to private sector participation. What form of private sector participation are we looking at? Both to share risk as well as to assist in bringing in efficiency. And so that's a method that should look at. The point you're raising around how do we do so in a manner that is careful that we don't essentially just give away the family jewels, because that has happened before. I mean, this issue that you're raising is correct what happens, because that has happened before, where we went, for example, in a rather strange and bizarre arrangement some years back. We went into a concession arrangement in Zambia for operating rail. And I always, when I talk about this, something I started to understand. You have an Israeli business people who come here and say, look, we want to throw you in to a business arrangement because we get into Zambia. We've got connections there. And now they're telling an SOE owned by a government, led by a governing party, which has been has spent a lot of time in Zambia, for example. But there we are, we're having this from Israel, and we'll organize and arrange a concession there. And where we found effectively, we got into a concession where we took more of the risk and less of the benefit. So a lot of effort is therefore being taken around dealing with that. But the benefit, of course, now is with the PFMA, those major strategic partnerships or business ventures, joint ventures that have been added into, have to be equally approved in terms of 1354 by the executive authority, the Minister of Public Finance. And those sectors are equally taken into account. That I can make an example, for example, when FAA wants to enter into the statistics of the star line, a lot of those sectors needed to be presented to the minister to approve that, take into account what are the benefits that will be accruing to you relative to the loss that you come across? Clearly, the issues of partnership is important. The way you around the way in which we structure those partnerships is important. And of course, as I said, that includes both our partnerships internally here, as we look into public sector participation, PPPs within South Africa. A lot of legal factors that should be considered around how we deal with those. Local manufacturing. I indicated earlier that we agree a lot more could be done. As when you raise the point around the goods that is actually, for example, iron ore, that leaves our market for other destinations with raw materials. And you are looking into what are the opportunities that are really come back is more. I don't know, it may well be that, and part of that cargo is captured by SAA as a finished product. But a lot of this, bear in mind, a lot of the iron ore we're selling out is iron ore destined for China. And a lot of that iron ore destined for China is essentially used mainly in the construction process. Inside of a study for the organization process. But this does not take us away from the proper focus that's going to be given to the steps around local content manufacturing in South Africa. Well, it is very clear that with the amount we're spending in our second investment program, if you put in a bit of that locally here, you'd make a major difference. In terms of employment here and generating activity in the economy here. So that's a key factor. I mean, for example, just dealing now, I mean, which is with another point which came to which we've raised around fleet planning. Yes, we have a fleet plan. The acquisitions that we've been doing in terms of our locomotives are in accordance with that fleet plan. And which
what
we
would. What is the time range for the 20 years, 25 years?
The different range, I mean, the medium, the medium term requirement that we have is set out in that plan around what it is looking for. For example, we've now ordered 100, we put up a tender for essentially what we call 100 off the shelf locomotives. And part of the engagement involving that is that if we have emphasized correctly, that there must be a clear plan around the local content manufacturing in the back of that 100. So the 100 that is required to be delivered next year. That is correct already now, of course, we'll be getting another 50, which we are actively involved in the assembly through the partnership with EMD. And then we have a 50 which is being assembled at our own facilities at Stafford Bay in Italy. But I think the point would be more helpful for us to put before you the full fleet plan. I don't have it with me for our locomotive renewal process, but we have a fleet plan and we'll be able to share that with the portfolio committee. The issue around planning with other SOEs, I'm sure we could do more with that, and I think when I was looking into the mandate of GPE set out there, I think GPE would itself be in a better position to assist us in understanding the areas where there could be better alignment between ourselves and the other SOEs. I think I'll finish on the question that will be directed to Charles.
Thank you. I'm
going to
pass on to
if I can just a tariff issue, I don't think I need that, but just to indicate that in respect of port tariffs, there may very well be a case that South African port tariffs are higher than many in other parts of the world. The challenge that we face, though, is that transport is very dependent on the tariffs from the ports which come through the balance sheet of NPA. And that is really the focus under which they are able to construct infrastructure ahead of demand. So we are not suggesting that we should be charging tariffs that are significantly higher than than competitors around the world. But we are suggesting that through the regulator, a more realistic approach to tariff setting for port takes place in such a way that we're able to reinvest sustainably in port infrastructure. Because it's very clear that with growth in container facilities and requirements in ports, if we undercharge for port services and we don't invest in critical infrastructure, we will be stuck in a situation where when the economy picks up again, we will have significant congestion and we will restrict growth within the national economy.
We don't want it to add tariffs.
No. So the challenge is getting the tariff rate at the right level. That's all I really want to say.
Thank you very much.
Dan,
from
work? Yeah.
Thank you. I'll start at the top, the form of compensation in terms of denied points. We have a denied point policy that we've just drawn up, and that's now being aligned to the new consumer protection legislation. Once that is, that will be very clear as to what the compensation would be in terms of the passenger that has been delayed due to overbooking position or whatever it may be. In Europe, of course, it's all legislated what these payments are, and as soon as we are together with the consumer protection legislation, it will be circulated and everybody will know exactly what it is. It's not in place already. It will be in place within a very short period of time. They have a denied boarding policy at the moment, but it's not just aligned with the new regulation. Okay, on the outsourcing and the job security, the main outsourcing that we're doing at the airport is for the handling. That is something that has been outsourced to third parties for many, many years. It's not something that's new. With the new legislation in, or the new rules from ACTA rather, all the contractors that have been employed in the past by the handling companies has to be full-time employees. They're not allowed to use contractors anymore. So most, if not, well, a very high percentage of the employees are now full-time employees, especially those working what we call on the air side. So everybody that's involved with baggage handling or anything that happens within the security area on the airport by the extra rules must be full-time employees. They cannot. The Star Alliance, the destinations and the number of flights, obviously that is the number of flights in the destination served by all the Star Alliance members all over the world, coming from Air New Zealand in the south up to Air Canada in the north. And for each point we'll be flying in, we'll have Star Alliance partner or partners. The moment our aircraft lands there are connections onwards for the passengers to go to any point in the world practically where they wish to go. I understand with 56 aircraft it's impossible to serve the number of flights, but that's where it comes from. It is really talking about somebody else's flight there. The aircraft lease and purchase, the current fleet is a mixed fleet of leases and purchases. Of the 9 AC-4600, 6 are owned, 3 is leased. The 300, 3 leased, 3 owned. 3-4200, all 6 are leased. Then on the short haul boats, the 77-800, 21 of them, which 4 are operating from Mango, all on leases. And the 319, there's 11 of them, they're all on leases. And the 4 cargo aircraft that we talked about, the 77-200 and 300, they all 4 on.
So we only actually own 6, 7, 8, 9 aircraft.
That is correct. The original purchase of the Airbus, which was the 340, 300, 600, 319, and 320, were all purchased by SAA. The 600, some of them were taken delivery of as ownership, and then later there was a sale and a lease back in 1952. The three aircraft that are not owned in terms of the C-40-300, or the three that are owned, are financed by the EPA in Europe, the Export Credit Agency. And the others are also on the sale and lease back, but they were sold directly to the lessor from Airbus, so we never took ownership of it.
So, can I just on a point of clarity ask, if we are only owning 9 aeroplanes and the rest are leased, is it a lease, apparently, if we buy them and we change over to a lease agreement as soon as we get them, then it's better to lease them, but why would you lease them otherwise? It must be making more sense to lease them. So why do we want to buy all these aeroplanes now if we can lease them and pay them as we use them? I mean, obviously when you lease, the servicing and everything falls on the person that leases it out. You get the guarantees and all the things don't matter. If it's like leasing a car, I would think it would be more or less the same thing.
Yeah, I think we should be clear that sale and lease back in the past was pretty easy to do. At the moment, it's not. If we look at some of the big leasing companies that we're dealing with, Royal Bank of Scotland, who owns all of the C-19s that we've got, they've just been bailed out by the UK government. They have no money. And so we can go down to General Electric Capital Service. They have more aircraft on order than what they can pay for. Because the problems that we experience in raising the finance in order to take delivery of the aircraft, they have exactly the same problem. There are no money available in the world. I mean, we're talking here of roughly $1.2 billion that we need to raise in order to fund these aircraft.
To buy them.
Sorry, $600 million.
To buy.
To purchase them.
Not at least.
No. But whoever needs
the one is you pay now, and the other one is you pay over the time you use now, I think. All right.
Whoever will take the ownership of the aircraft needs to get that capital amount somewhere from a bank. And in the current circumstances, that is very difficult. And if you can get financing, it is very expensive. Very expensive.
So if the state would borrow you the money, would we get it back?
Well, if the state can buy the aircraft and lease them to us, obviously they will get their money back over the period of the lease.
And it just sounds like we need to pay money and then not get anything back to them. Because they want to be, they need the money to be bailed out.
No, I think if there is a sale and lease back, whoever the owner is of the aircraft gets the money back over a period of time. Because the lease rate includes a portion which is interest based and a portion which is capital. Then you do get the capital back, and at the end of the period, hopefully you have an asset that's of value. Is there anything else on
the
list? Then the service
contract to India.
Yeah, I'll deal with that now. The servicing of aircraft, we did outsource 3 A340-200 D-checks last year to China. The reason for that was that we had quite a number of the wide-body aircraft that came in on the same timing for the major check. Now, a major check in terms of these aircraft is 40,000 to 45,000 man hours per aircraft. With the reduction or the loss of quite a number of technicians within FA Technical, we did not have the capacity to do it in-house. So we outsourced those in China. We have the manpower to do it. But at the same time, FA Technical sent a team over to oversee the total service to be done. So the servicing was done there.
To shadow.
No, not to shadow, to oversee. To ensure that the service that has been rendered there complies with the standards that we apply in South Africa, so that we don't get an aircraft back that has been rebuilt. Because during that V-check, you take the aircraft totally apart, take everything out inside, rebuild it, so it has to be done to a certain standard because the next check is 8 years away. If you don't do it properly, you have a lot of problems during that period. So that is where that is coming from.
This is the problem I'm having. You are saying that we want to become the place where the people must bring the airplanes and not want to bring it here because we are the best. Now, how are we going to come become the best? Have you got a plan in place? Are you training the people that we will have enough to, so that we, they don't send it to us and we send it back to China? I mean, because that doesn't seem like it's the right thing to do.
No, it's not the right thing to do. I think what we have to put in perspective is that, as I said, we have brought in a lot of the aircraft that was delivered in short time period. That came in at the same time for the major check. So there was a big problem in terms of that. Also, the aircraft that we are looking in the area are mainly smaller aircraft. So the sizes of the checks are much smaller than what we used to. The other thing that we need to keep in mind is that with a lot of technicians and the very little training that's been done in the past, there is a huge shortage, and I don't think we are unique in having a shortage of technical skills. I think it's throughout the country. But SA Technical is working on that, and they're taking in roughly about 100 to 150 they need per year at the moment in order to address that. Because our technicians are quite well sought after in the Middle East, Australia, New Zealand, all of those places, because of the quality of the people that we turn out of the training school.
And obviously we don't train them enough to keep them here.
Well, it's very difficult to compete, especially with the Middle East. Those guys are paying tax-free, and it's very difficult because that's one of the problems that we're facing in South Africa, especially from an SAP point of view, is that our cost of manpower is much higher than what it should be. The cost of a man hour in South Africa is roughly about 2.5 times than what it is in China.
The quality of manpower now and human, don't understand.
Human power.
No, sir, but you say it takes a cycle of 8 years to.
Yes.
Do you have plans to make sure that when the next round comes, we have produced enough engineers of the right quality, not only to make sure that that will be done locally, but to say that then you realize your vision of being the place that's desired by all to do that kind of thing of maintenance and stuff?
Yes. With the next round of checks, we would probably have trained sufficient people to be able to do it in
time. I think probably.
Because we don't know what's going to happen. We may be losing half of them again. We don't know.
Can't we go into a contract where we pay for their education or we educate them that they must work here for 5 years or 10 years or whatever? Can't we tie them down in some manner that they have to work here?
We have bonded some of them in the past. The employers come and pay the bond.
Peter, I'm just conscious. I know this is a valid question. I've also got a right to play here referring to come and munch me up. So please allow me to the first answer. I have missed nothing.
The problem is mainly as a result of trying to retain people. Then the readiness of disaster teams. ACTA, ourselves, are doing exercises every year. Every year we've got a practical exercise where we do that in conjunction with the emergency services. So I think we would welcome anybody that wants to come and see what we have and how ready we are.
Um,
because I think we've addressed the issues around the camp, the outposts, that all outposts will be taking a full time interview. The corporate social investment, yes, it is, we definitely do have a policy that we do not invest much. We do more emotional investment. For example, we identify projects that we get involved in, we collect, we make personal sacrifices. You know, for example, we do a blanket collection and identify areas where we could go out and do work. We have what we call a next day, make a difference day, and we go out and make a difference around painting, but it does not come from the organization coffers. We take the responsibility as employees to do those collections and write up the event. The reason being that with our low somehow cash, we definitely do not put hundreds of thousands or millions into corporate social investment. But we have got programs. So when we discuss the plans of SAA, you'll see the various programs that we do, but they are funded. For example, the one big fund we have is in the South Warner magazine with our advertising. That advertising revenue is sent out into a corporate social investment fund. And that fund then goes out and identifies projects whereby SAA goes out and
I realized that I've forgotten to come back in on the corporate social investment. We've certainly been approached. We have chosen areas of involvement, and they've really been around education, health, art and culture, sports and global. We look at, we try when we see the life of Steven Pinar and Bennett Parker, who came through the Sussex School of Excellence. We also have a focus around what we call containerizers. So some of these containers are no longer of use. We then get, we use them in various communities as sort of community centers for even the service of some social grants and the like. What we are now starting is pretty much what SAA is focusing on, which is employee volunteerism, employee participation. Where rather than putting money, which is fine, we will continue to do money, we need to get the culture of our own employees getting involved in what we call.
We spoke about risk management. Yes, we have a definite risk management plan. In the type of industry that we're in, we definitely have identified the categories that are risky for us. There is a controlled and an uncontrollable risk based on aircraft, disasters, and air. They are all identified. We can come around with a plan and show you what they are specifically. Some of the issues and challenges that we saw today come up from our risk plan. Those are the fast-track issues that are risky, that are more a going concern type issues that we're dealing with. But there is a detailed plan.
Can I just, I know you've asked the plan before, but we did.
Yes.
And I know that we asked specifically whether you print and invest strategic picture. We want to the last time before Andres and you employed an ex-MIT agent from Britain. So this doesn't only come in terms of the law, stock, etc. It comes also with things like being cajoled into by the Israelis to go and do, to go pushing their risk in Zambia. So we hope that when you employ moving forward, you will screen people thoroughly. Because that is risky not to do that, especially people who are always occupied very strategic.
And leave it to the shareholders to explain. I'm not too sure. I think the process is in with the board, and the board is a guest will be going to the board in our process. That's why it has been put out publicly in the paper for the best candidates to get. So I think it is definitely that the choice lies with the board to recommend to the different parties.
I'm not going to apply.
tomorrow is still on Friday. We talked again about SAA being a frequent airline, not notified you. I think the whole event that we presented to you are events that somehow are not controllable in our case. If you look at the EU Commission, we still maintain that we've done nothing wrong. We were in trade within the cargo industry. We have a proper agreement. We did not agree on price. So there is no rule that we have breached, and that's why we've been very open about giving out the information. And secondly, yes, maybe you can say risk of exploitation and the losses around 2003. We take accountability down, we are not there. But it's all historic issues, legacy issues that go with any legacy failure. That does not necessarily put us as a delinquent airline, but it more puts us into a point where we need to be careful about our future strategy, future choice of people, leadership, and make sure that we get the right people to lead the organization into better. And we need to have the right control measures and support as well from traders, for example, to ensure that none of your hedge losses and issues like that happen. So it is really applying that diligently in going forward in terms of our operations. Currently, gives us a total growth. Our turnover is 2.5 billion. We give SAA 1.2 billion in profit. Yet we don't pay for a belly space, which probably if we did, it will account for about 50% of that. So cargo as a standalone business is a 600 million business. It is very profitable because 50% of the cargo that we carry, which is inside the belly, which is the airline belly, everywhere that the airline goes, we go along, we check along, which is a very, I'll say that, very good for us. We have an additional four planes that do 40% of the revenue. We do have a very thin margin, but then there's been a renegotiation of the lease of the two aircraft, they are two, and we got them far much cheaper than the previous price, and we are looking into growth. We've just started flying into Rwanda about 2 weeks ago, so we definitely are looking for long-term growth in Africa to move a whole lot of things out. We do work with some of the SOEs in a form of contract. For example, Freight Dynamics comes out and takes a lot of our cargo where we so there is, and I agree with you that there could be much more synergy in terms of working together. A whole lot of the cargo movement of goods is more skewed to your highly sensitive, high sensitive goods, which are your telecommunications. We move a lot of telecommunications. We move car parts for the whole industry. So Islanda is a really big place for us. So with a lot of working together, we could find opportunities. However, we do speak about those opportunities because most of the SOEs are our corporate clients. I mean, Transnet gives us a very high base revenue in terms of flying. I think they almost exclusively use SAA, and we've got a very good relationship in terms of working together to find other opportunities. For example, we want to come and advertise on the IFE inside and we're talking to how do we help each other in terms of the exclusivity for flight, and then we get other added value benefits. So there are talks, but we could be well improved. SAA has a turnaround strategy. When we get the second chance, the second round chance, we'll come around to implement our plan. The turnaround strategy is around Africa. We're talking a lot, and Andrew has
Mark said, a lot of times of what we want to do in Africa, where fact is growing and where we plan as well to be, but we want to position ourselves as a very strong ally in the domestic market, so that we can feed into a region and ultimately feed into our international culture. So when we were looking at that plan, but as we might see, that is constrained by homework of our issues that we presented before, that we need to balance it, and that doesn't enable us to go any further than where we are. So our growth is more accessible, but refocusing, we are taking effort from one place, we said that we are really looking at one, and then we put more into the other. The other is Africa, so Africa is a piece of growth that we need. In the long plan, we have all available. We've got a plan with 12 things about. We put together a plan that is what basically things in terms of where we want to be, what our market is going to look like, and who we want to service. And we're very confident that if we somehow go through the kind of service we have, we're going to be able to comfortable. We have a pre-planning strategy done with the team around the software strategy, including with synopsis of how that works and what is owned and what is used. And as we improve the balance sheet, I'm sure we'll be able to do that. The last question is the call center again. The call center had a serious problem just around the time we had a crash, and we had no option but to open up the rest of the other call centers we have around the world, so that we could serve and that's the full stuff. When we did that, we got a lot of very positive results in that the international call centers were much more productive in terms of the average call time and the average service time. So it's very principle and the average 3 minutes, 2 to 3 minutes that we covered it. And that really helped us during the time. I agree that somehow once we get people to know that they're talking to somebody that's far, the accents are different and people struggle, but it does work very well for us. And the cost thereof, because it's in the same platform and it's on Skype, it's technology that's making us very productive in that. The average call, think about it, our average call time with the US and the UK call centers are less than 2 minutes. So the guys are so quick, but it's on Skype, which is far much cheaper. It's on the same, actually much cheaper base than what it is in there. It is.
It's cheaper to use those.
Yeah, very cheaper for us, because it sits on the platform, it has the infrastructure, it is right, and you can get in there and use it. So we will not burden cost in terms of that, but we've improved a lot of So it does work for us. I think that's the last question I have. Is there any other thing else that I've got?
There's one question that we've got unanswered, but if nobody's going to follow up, I won't follow you. No. Andrew, did you want to?
Just one or two minor issues. Certainly. In respect of the Airbus transaction and the issue of ownership versus lease versus how we proceed with that contract, SAA, together with ourselves, have approached National Treasury, and we would seek the most cost-effective solution and the most sustainable solution for SAA going forward, where we would minimise any kind of government support for that part of the transaction that may be required. So the first issue. The second issue, SAA Technical. One of the department's projects is to work with SAA to establish SAA Technical as a greater independence of the airline. As SAA become part of a much more competitive airline market, the best maintenance of the maintenance facility in South Africa turns out to be SAA Technical. Comair, for example, BA Domestic, they have all their maintenance, or the majority of their maintenance, to SAA Technical. We are working on a program to try and enhance SAA Technical focus on multi-operators, which would attract airlines from other parts of Africa, even other parts of the Southern Hemisphere, to do maintenance there. So that is one of the projects that we have on our schedule of things to do. The last issue that I'd like to speak to is the issue of the CEO.
was that the advert had gone out. The process is managed by the SAA board. We had requested the board to have it, well, they requested our input on the advert. What we indicated is that we would support not only an advertising process but also a headhunting process, because not only do you have to find with the requisite skills to actually become CEO of that airline. There is a process of getting all the candidates in that process, a recruitment agency is in the process for that purpose. The board would ultimately make recommendations on the shortlist to the minister.
So,
why the agencies are responsible for setting up the initial shortlist and for establishing whether there's any challenges in respect of the basic vetting that they normally do, which would be vetting of academic records, assessment of any criminal records that they may have, etc. That's a basic vetting process that most of the recruitment agencies use. Particularly in filling a post as senior as a CEO.
This is I'm requesting that the law enforcement agents, not law enforcement, media in particular, should be involved in screening the candidates.
Well, perhaps what we can do is involve make a recommendation to involve them once the shortlist has come down to a reasonable number of people. I don't think that would be very
difficult.
Yeah,
no, that's the point where I think
I meant the empathy on intra-Africa trade and also working with business directors transfer and also working with other developing countries like Brazil. You know, as the old saying goes, charity is in the home. In Africa, for instance, if you want to do business, expand onto the African continent, as I said, I like that. But what is your growth plan in relation to infrastructure development? Noting that not all of our sister countries on the continent have a developed infrastructure in terms of your railway lines, telecommunication line that are needed to run an efficient business. And secondly, the Nalezi pool. Can I check, you said there are eight. Can I check where are they situated? And what's the criteria in that kingdom? I'm raising this because at the back of my mind I was born in Alice. There are two schools who are specializing in the science and information. How old they depart on the fact. I just wanted to check your criteria and if you have any school in the same case that is already in the Alice program. And lastly, for Transnet, I know that I was talking about this during the break. I'm really worried about the lack of investment that is being put into the different companies. Noting that it is not only catering for your game, like how it's like this London, but with the rhythm and revitalization of the Malta, which is an industrial area, and also Batawan, which is also an industrial area, surely Transnet has got to consider properly resources that happen. As I was saying to you, I was told that the enterprise like in Germany had to reroute and a project which was first to improve. A project which they wanted to assemble a certain model of their car. It had to be taken to Brazil precisely because they felt that the Island of Harbor was not big enough to carry volume for export. Now to South Africa Airways, I must say this upfront. I intend sending a question to the new president. I'm just finalizing my research around it. I've been already informed that a substantial number of your pilots are on retirement stage. There is an allegation that there is insufficient training of pilots to substitute or to replace those that are going on replacement. Can I get a comment in that? And the last one, Shepherdson, is to Dr. Shaw. In slide 9, he mentions that the plan of the department is to position South African Express away as an ally on its own. It's a bit problematic for me because I have thought that given the cabinet time that the South African Airways finds itself in and the fact that South African Express have got a healthier balance sheet, I would have imagined that instead of taking them apart further, as we have taken them away from Transnet and through the disastrous consequences of that. I would imagine that instead of putting them apart further, we would rather be talking about bringing them together so that they share notes, good practices, and eventually have a national carrier that you can totally be so proud of. Thank you.
Eric, I've done for 4 years, you ask questions very rarely, so.
Thank you, Sir. My question is directed to Sydney and Francis. Just wanted to find out in terms of government, whether you have managed to meet or employ any criticism in terms of gender, as well as. The second question relates to risk, to the risk analysis management unit of SEA. I'm talking about the commercial decisions that have been taken in the past 5 years. For example, why have you came to the committee and then said you have sold two of your aircraft or more? And that's a book, and then when the committee asked you why, and then they say that because one cut the code, especially on the mainland. And then a year after, it came back, and then the jet was crowded in the car. And then the committee asked why, and then they said, because the roof conditioning operation was not good. But you still have to pay the 2% of the contract. Up on the airport, why would have expected that for risk analysis management unit would have done its job to analyze the risk involving the RDCs for in the right line impact? For example, instead of 15 aircraft, you might have seen 5. Maybe you could have said in the long term, the route in which you want to go. mortified as they are because they cannot do it at all, because they are grown up, and then the company will give the opportunity. Otherwise we find another solution, and we say, go find your own way to privatize it together with South African Express. The two of them, they have a much better balance sheet together. But it would not be a sale on the basis of the balance sheet. It would be a sale on the basis of the opportunity, where they draw to the international market, the domestic market. They put together a plan of investment for a continental expansion, and this operation expanded of co-standard as a joint venture with African, other African countries of private investors. It's a matter for me even now, how to create the crisis, create the opportunity. By the same token, France may. And I don't want to be single-minded in my vision of it. Apartheid gives a certain mindset in the SOD. Sometimes it was an SOD mindset, but seen as it may. And that mindset has continued. I'm not saying it's the wrong mindset, but there is a continuity from the past to the present. The one I think at this juncture needs to determine whether for the long-term future this continuity remains viable. And Transnet is the expression of this mindset. I ask myself the question, it's a legitimate question. Why should we not have people? Of course, not necessarily which belong to the city, which are a city dimension in terms of the port authority, completely separate in a competing environment, which is the model throughout the Western world, at least those I've seen. And some of those issues dealing with the MTA, with the regulation, with the tariffs, which just sort themselves out without us having to deal with them, trying to predict the future, and we just got down to massive forces. The third point that in reaction to Andrew's presentation, I personally am a little wary about the state agreement logistics apparatus. We need to really be conscious before we move into creating a state logistics apparatus of the potential anti-competitive effect. There we know that the state competing with its citizens, because if it's wrong, and they can do it better, they can move faster, they can get more jobs than we do. And the last point on this is the rat and mouse issue, but I want to mention it's not on the case, on the corporate social responsibility interventions in the public sector, because you also respond to the pressure we do. I would like to caution, I don't think that they have a responsibility to conduct any social responsibility intervention beyond what makes it say. Because if we say that we end up in this contradiction of not believing that the budgetary cycle does what it's supposed to be doing, we're taking money out of the national revenue fund, we are giving them to them, so we divert them from social services for them to reapply as they want to social responsibility projects. It's contradictory. We work for the private sector. The public sector should not involve in itself in things like information. It's into that nature. And sorry, it's not me to be the CEO. I do have mission. The NIA is quite clear.
Thank you. I'll do my value. That's the first point around the intra-African infrastructure development. Clearly, it's an area of focus we have, and we've actually started engagement around it. We have cut it on it at our summit session, our expert summit session content. Naturally, it's a matter that we can't deal with without the shareholder. We've not even taken that to the board, especially what we're looking for. And we have to go through the check of the board and the shareholder. But the point you're raising, we agree wholeheartedly that we've got to be in there. And the number of other players, whether you go to the World Economic Forum, there have been great issues around. A number of the African countries are getting involved in infrastructure. Little attention is being given to intra-Africa connectivity. So clearly, it's the right thing to do. The processes around it, as I said, I mean, clearly we've got to go through various processes around it, but there's no debate about ourselves that that's the proper thing to do. The Timalene schools, I'll rely to you about certainly the process relating to them, and it's a process we involve together with NERS around the Timalene school, and I would get you that information through, and provide it. Or we could bring it when we next come to see the portfolio committee. We can provide that information. And look, Trusted Impact does more than the Dinamation Schools are educated. We also have what we call the Tough Minds Get Ahead in Life. And also targeting rural schools on the next slide. Whether or not we've got representation in the area that you refer to, Alice, I don't know. But I can that information I can provide you or others. It's London Port. I've heard we will be in East London on the 27th of August, and I'm sure a number of the players in East London will be engaging us on that. And this is part of, I think, we are referred to as well as end refers to as the Transnational Infrastructure Plan. Cabinet approved that we have consultations around it. And part of those consultations include with provincial, local governments, and other role players in the various places. So we've had them now since the 21st of July in Tswane, Johannesburg, Tswane, Devon, the Cape Bay. We have it in Cape Town today, Saldanha Bay tomorrow, Bloemfontein, Kimberley, Port Elizabeth, East London we have on the 27th. Nelspruit, 2nd September, and Mabaso. So that's a process around ensuring that there is engagement and we listen to people around what more better could we do in this infrastructure plan. And out of that, clearly there may be changes coming out of that based on what is looked at and also assessed in terms of the free demand assessment that we have. If you say, as indicated to us, that Mercedes-Benz says, well, the demand is high and the capacity is not meeting the demand, you've got to deal with that. So what you've raised will certainly form part of the conversation process around the next month.
Will you give us that progress so that we members can?
Okay, all right. I will get my office to send that. Economic regulation is really a big, tough issue. And maybe just, I'll just quote from the Minister Hogan's budget speech, where he says the current regulatory system was established during a period of minimal investment and has not been adequately revised. That's one key point. And that's given the accumulated backlog of investment in infrastructure, it's critical that we create an environment where the private sector can participate in the system alongside SOEs and not in substitution of SOEs. In the present world, while economic recession and the lack of huge backlog of infrastructure investment, the SOEs must necessarily expand the rollout of their infrastructure program. What we've seems to be happening, though, in the light of all of this, is that current port and pipeline regulators mandate, in our view, seem to encourage tariffs to set low at the expense of long-term infrastructure. And we're saying that we are adopting a short-termism approach, and we'll be caught out around it. And so we've got to figure out what is appropriate at a time of investment. And the other point we've been raising is around inconsistent and discretionary regulation rules creating uncertainty and risk for investment planning. I attended last year in Ghana a meeting of the African Forum of Utility Regulation, and one of the most fundamental points raised was that for regulation certainty to exist, you need to introduce reduced discrepancy. You need to have the rules of the game understood and applied consistently at all times. The slide I showed you reflects that we have on the one hand in the same economic environment, we got no increase. And we can't understand why there wasn't. On the other hand, there is 4% increase. On the other, there is suddenly a point of saying that there should be, in fact, a decrease. So now the question is that it was a lawful, it's a lawful decision. And what we're saying is we've got to ensure that an environment is created to support the public sector, to invest in critical infrastructure, so that we're able to meet the demand on the South African economy, particularly when there's an upswing. We can't allow another moment to come when we miss out on the opportunities as it happens. If you take, for example, in the commodities boom, South Africa benefited only on price, not on volume. And we could have benefited more if we were able to allow for more export. But we were constrained by the infrastructure issues that we had. So what we are seeking and really are looking for is engagement and assistance by this portfolio committee around what is appropriate to ensure that the public sector, because you could either have an approach to say government is going to put the money. If government says, no, we want to put money in other areas of strategic importance to the state, whether it's healthcare, it's education, etc., and that you must be able to fund the infrastructure investment on the strength of your balance sheet, we believe that the policy and regulation environment should equally be supportive of that. And that is the engagement that we're seeking. We believe that the statement that the minister made in the budget vote is consistent, consistent with that point. Coming to the Gabrielini, on the issue of city ports, and you said that we've gotten caught up in a mindset from the old time, which has remained consistent with us, and you seem to believe that it is a wrong mindset. Certainly, we don't believe that is the case. And also, I mean, if you've got to look into, and you know this very well, and you went into the constitutional drafting process of this country. That was not a competence given to the local fee of government. But more importantly, the idea of having force competing to us does not support the need for to work out a mechanism to lower the cost of doing business in this country. And the point is, always wanted to emphasize, lowering the cost of doing business in South Africa is not essentially just about ensuring that Transnet charges the lowest fare. It is about Transnet creating the necessary efficiency for business to thrive, for exporters to export most effectively, and therefore be able to compete with the rest of the players in the country. So that's what we're looking at. And so for us, we always said the best approach to take is one of adopting a complementary approach to your port, so that you have greater focus in different areas. So we use, for example, Saldanha as a critical focus area for iron ore. We could add in there maybe something more like manganese, that we could always have. But we want to have a way around focusing our port around. This one is our transshipment hub. So our approach has been to work them out in a complementary fashion. As we've done, and we've done that for them to link up to the total supply chain relating to the various commodities that we focus on. So we remaining in that position. We don't believe it is a wrong position. And in fact, what we're seeing happening in others with the life of the port of Rotterdam, themselves looking at, amongst other things, leakages to do with race, or the life of Deutsche Bahn looking into opportunities where they could get into port as part of their total supply chain, suggests that, in fact, in South Africa, whether by design or by mere blessing, we have this integrated supply chain system. All we've got to do is to make sure that it works efficiently to ensure that the South African economy is competitive.
You know, sorry, I have promised a hard stop at after sports and those who have to fly out.
Yeah.
And one of them. So again, always generous with your answers. Can I just ask that we spread some of the love quickly on some of the other questions? Jan Mangula, Andrew, just quickly your kind of closing comments on the question. Would you like a quick recap?
Okay.
I
think from the question, the number of pilots that's on retirement age, I'm not aware of exactly how many are close to retirement, but if there's one skill in South Africa that there's not a shortage of pilots, it may not be of the right background in terms of the demographics, but there are plenty of pilots in South Africa, and every pilot in South Africa wants to fly for SAA because that is the ultimate thing. So I cannot see for the life of me that SAA will have a shortage of pilots in this current environment at all. Where we do have a risk, and I think we've alluded to that before, is more on the technical side, the technicians, where we have to say there are not technicians available, and there are also quite a number of people that is coming or becoming older and will become less for some in the future.
The
employment
equity, we are
taking a few
decisions our target. And both are at a very good level and a senior level as well. We've got challenges in some of the other vertical management areas. We are building the gap to a very young senior and the title of the management. And we're going to do it. And I think somehow that we're working through the first time. But the rest of the organization is going to overtime.
Quality of your risk analysis unit? That is one of the questions. Do you want to respond?
Yeah. I think we have a very good risk register in terms of what the major risks in the airline are. And each one of those has got a mitigation plan that goes along with that. And if necessary, we can share that with you at some point exactly how we rate the risk and how the mitigation plans are put together. I think that goes along with the question around the Airbus and the order and why was there not the risk done. I'm not sure what the situation was at the time, but I have to add that I don't think it is normal to purchase the aircraft for delivery 9 years in advance. You have to buy forward because they are not like target items from the store, but certainly 9 years in advance is a very long time.
Andrew,
quickly,
that you think
SAA split? Okay, in respect of SAA, part of the analysis leading up to the strategy was to look at different types of ownership structures. There's two reasons why we decided to keep SAA and SAA as separate airlines. We are not making them separate, they are, in fact, historically separate. So, and the first of those was that when we looked at regional carriers around the globe, we found that most of them were separate from the mainline carriers. Different type of business. It has a different focus, and the reason that it's kept separately is it also uses different types of equipment. The second reason is that if we combine the balance sheet of SAC and SAA together, we wouldn't improve the overall position of a joint airline, because the balance sheet of SAA is so weak and so large compared to the balance sheet of SAC, which is so much smaller but better, that when we looked at the opportunity for regional expansion in Africa, SAC with its current balance sheet was in a much better position if it acted separately to begin to go into joint ventures with other players in other parts of Africa.
What we also came to the conclusion in doing the analysis is that this was put up for debate. In other words, we would progress the strategy with two separate airlines, but at a later point in time, we may revisit that approach and that strategy of potentially bringing them together at a later point. So it's not completely discounted, but for the current time, and in order to enhance expansion into Africa now, the logic is to keep them separate for this.
And in your last comment on a national logistics framework and something that you mentioned, potential.
On the anti-competitive side, I think we are worried about that. We face the same challenges in Essence. We certainly face them with any kind of corporate venture that an entity such as Comcast does with the private sector. There are many players out there which could align themselves with Comcast in a way that ultimately turns out to be anti-competitive. What we would encourage is that there's a proper and transparent process of identifying which players play which role in such a way that we can ensure transparency. There is transparency in the court process. There, however, is no clear legislative transparency in the case of rail.
Thank you. So, Madam Chair, the Premier says, where did all the time go? And I'm not quite sure. I think it's Johnny saying, yeah? Where did the good time go? We seem to have run out of time. I was remiss yesterday, but I'm not today. And that is, you know, when we put together a school like this, I rely on the goodwill, essentially, of the people I interact with. People like Philip, as I said earlier in the day. You know, I'm not like Parliament who can call and people. And I'd be remiss in not saying thank you. And sometimes a token goes a bit further than just a thank you. And you know, it won't break any PSMA regulations. It's absolutely phenomenal, but it gives me great pleasure to thank each of the people who agreed to come and speak and take the flag and share the podium with me. Thank you, and Phyllis, thank you very much. And I'll make sure the folks from the Lao get it from yesterday.
Our two friends are coming.
So I wish us all of our laughs, if you like. Thank you. Then, finally, we are having dinner tonight again at 7 at the hotel. We had a great dinner last night. Everyone's invited who's around. And then tomorrow, just our way of logistics, we need to check out ourselves before we come down here because we'll be passing the program during checkout time. So we need to, and Uber has been kind enough to organize a room where we can store our luggage until we leave for the afternoon.
I won't be eating dinner with you. I was around the shop. I don't work at this parliament as soon as we finish here, so don't be surprised if you won't see me at dinner. I will not be sitting here either.
I would want to be eating dinner if the menu is changed
tonight. but for next time, it's a great loss that they present and go and present and go and present and go. I know we are next time will be a surprise. But,
you're getting
your own. I don't blame you. Just lamenting loudly that it would be nice. I mean, we try to stay here at Nebraska. We know it's for our benefit. But we think the synergies are also important between the SOE. So we depend on the department, actually, but we start in this way. This tendency is also prevalent when we call it together to the portfolio committee. We normally call it together whether it's deliberately two or three people together because we would have gone through a thing where we wanted to sit together and act. But normally just present and go and present and go and present. But I didn't want to waste it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
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 I don't know what I'm saying.
I'm going to pick him up. It's all my...
Good morning.